during National Foster Care Month, promoting lifelong family connections for all kids in foster care at aecf.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible with support from Art Mart in Lincoln Square, Urbana. Art Mart offers unique items for the home and kitchen and a deli and bakery featuring Reuben's Chocolates. Art Mart is pleased to support public radio.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us today. Carol Casella is a writer. She is also an anesthesiologist, and she is out now with her first novel. It's titled Oxygen. It's described as an exploration of medical ethics, moral responsibility, and compassion. The protagonist of this novel, Oxygen, is Dr. Marie Heaton. And like her novelist creator, she too is an anesthesiologist. In the opening paragraphs of the novel, Heaton talks about her job and the importance of oxygen. She says, "I am an anesthesiologist, a practitioner of the art and science of anesthesia." The word means literally no sensation. In our modern lexicon, it denotes a temporary loss of sensation, an absence of pain during an otherwise painful procedure. That is how I see my job, to make painful events painless, to coax and manipulate the human mind, to give up its fierce clutch on control, its evolutionary reflex to flee from dismemberment and violation. If I deserted my patient deep in that swale of sleep, a suffocation colored blood blue, the lips would turn violet, pink skin would dull to gray, and the steady beep, beep, beep of the heart monitor would fade, then falter. Like an archaeological ruin, the brain would die in levels. Personality, judgment, memory, movement, collapsing like falling bricks to crush the brainstem's steady pulse of breath and blood. So, that's from the opening of Oxygen. Now, what happens when something goes wrong? When a patient dies while deep in that swale of sleep? It happens in the novel. During an operation on an 8-year-old girl, something goes terribly wrong. The girl, Jolene Jansen, dies on the operating table. Is Dr. Heaton at fault? Had she in some way deserted her patient? This is how the novel is set in motion, but this is more than a suspense novel, more than a medical drama. It's also about what our work provides us, why we want to love what we do. It also asks if sometimes we derive too much of our sense of identity from that work. As the book's description puts it, as she struggles to salvage her career and reputation, Marie must face hard truths about the path she's chosen, the bridges she's burned, and the colleagues and superiors she's mistaken for friends. We'll talk with Carol Casella this afternoon about these questions and more. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Carol Casella, our guest, the mother of two sets of twins, practices anesthesiology in Seattle. She's also a freelance medical writer specializing in global public health advocacy for the developing world. She majored in English literature at Duke University and graduated from medical school in 1986. You'll find her online at carolcasella.com. And Casella is spelled with two S's and two L's. The book Oxygen is published by Simon & Schuster. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us, please do, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Carol Casella, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Celeste. I so appreciate your inviting me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a good read, and it is wonderful to talk with you this afternoon. Hope you're well. Hope things in Seattle are fine today.
They are. We finally have some sunshine here.
Very good. Very good. Well, I'm wondering if here at the outset, if you would read the opening of this novel, Oxygen, for us. It really pulls readers right into the story and gets us thinking about what it is that we do every moment of our lives, that is to breathe in and out.
Sure, I'd be happy to start. People feel so strong, so durable. I anesthetize airline pilots, corporate executives, high school principals, mothers of well-brought-up children, judges and janitors, psychiatrists and salespeople, mountain climbers and musicians, people who have strutted and struggled and breathed on this planet for 20, 30, 70 years, defying the inexorable entropic decay of all living things, all of them clinging to existence by one molecule, oxygen. The entire complex human machine pivots on the pinnacle of oxygen. The bucket brigade of energy metabolism that keeps us all alive ends with oxygen as the final electron acceptor. Take it away, and the cascade clogs up in minutes, backing up the whole precisely tuned engine until it collapses, choked, cold, and blue. Two portals connect us to oxygen, the mouth and the nose, appreciated more for all their other uses, tasting, smelling, smiling, whistling, blowing smoke and blowing kisses, supporting sunglasses and lipstick designers, perfumeries and plastic surgeons. Seal them for the duration of the morning weather report, and everything you had planned for the rest of your life evaporates in a puff of imagination. There is a moment during the induction of general anesthesia when I am intimately bonded to my patient, a moment of transferred power. I squeeze the drug out of the syringe into the IV line and watch the face slacken, watch the last organized thoughts slip from consciousness, see breathing shallow, slow, stop.
And that is Carol Casella reading the opening from her novel, Oxygen. Blowing smoke and blowing kisses. When did the opening of this book begin to take shape in your imagination? And I'm sure that it is something that you took a great deal of care with and maybe rewrote and rewrote.
I did. Those first paragraphs especially were rewritten more than any other part of the book. And they came to me really many years ago, early in my career as an anesthesiologist. There is a moment in the induction, which is the term we use for putting someone to sleep or the beginning of an anesthetic, when the drugs hit the brainstem in a large bolus and the patient falls into an extremely deep sleep, so deep that really if the anesthesiologist were to leave the scene at that moment, which of course they would never do, the patient would likely not survive. And so it's remarkably close to death, and it makes me think of the transparent line, the very narrow, narrow line that we all walk between life and death, and how tenuous that is, and how we can't obviously go through our day constantly being aware of that. It would immobilize you.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, to be aware of that now and then can make you so deeply appreciate the things that you do value in your life, the relationships. And so in the course of my work as an anesthesiologist and as a physician in general, I think I was able to become much more attuned to the sensitivity of how fragile life is. And I wanted to write about that. I wanted to capture that in fiction, in a novel, in a story.
Yeah. What led you to writing? When did you begin writing?
I actually began writing when I was 8 years old. I wanted to write long before I became a doctor. I've always loved reading and loved books and saw myself as a writer. But as I grew up into my early teens and my 20s, I didn't know how to pursue that path. It just seemed a bit vague. And, of course, the world tells you, well, get another day job, and you can do that on the side. Mm-hmm. And I also loved people. I loved the stories people told and decided to go into medicine. And medicine was a much more straightforward path. I could kind of find the train to get on there. But as I continued on in my life and reached middle age, which is a time when we all also begin to realize that life is not infinite, I really could not stop the voices that kept echoing inside my head. I really needed to start writing fiction. I had been writing medical literature for the global health world, and that also had a lot of creativity in it. And so I decided to blend these parts of my life.
Yeah. At your website, on your blog, you write, "I've always walked around with ceaseless narration ricocheting around in my brain. It gets quite noisy, almost intrusive, to tell the truth. I'd bet my career that every writer tolerates the same unvoiced cacophony." So what's that like?
Well, it does sometimes get intrusive. I find myself in the grocery store narrating what I see on the shelves, narrating a reaction to what I see, narrating what I see on the street, narrating scenes in the operating room. And I suppose it's my way of coping with the world and of making sense of the world. But I also think that I think many writers do this, and I think it's a way of plucking out from daily human experience what matters, what for some reason catches your attention and connects you to the rest of the world. And I tend to keep lists of those things in little notebooks that I carry around with me, and then I try to put them into my fiction as things that might speak to other readers as well.
Yeah. Now, when you're working with patients, you're there in an operating room, and someone is there, and you've put them to sleep. Are you able to think about that individual, their life, and is there some kind of narration going on there where you're both anesthesiologist, you're both doctor, and you're also a storyteller?
Very much so. One of the tricks in anesthesia is that we have a very, very brief time to meet our patients and get to know them. Most of the other doctors involved in your care get to know you over a period of time. Your family practitioner, your surgeon, you meet with them in the office before you go to the operating room, and then you meet your anesthesiologist right before you go inside to begin the operation. And it really is amazing to me that patients trust me after such a brief meeting. So I try to use that 5 minutes that we have to create some sort of a bond. Of course, I spend most of that time figuring out if there's any kind of physiological problem with the patient that might affect their anesthetic. But then I also try to make a connection. I like to know where people are from, what they do, what their family is like, and use that to help make some connection that could actually make their anesthetic turn out potentially better.
In the story with Jolene Jansen, as she's about to go under, our protagonist sings a lullaby to her. That's quite a connection.
I do that with children frequently.
Yeah.
I'll either tell them a story or tell them a lullaby, something to distract them, something so they're not thinking about the moment of going to sleep. It's a moment of complete loss of control, and that's really scary for people. It's been scary for me when I've had anesthesia and when I've been the parent of a child going under anesthesia. And I think it helps to be distracted into something that connects you in a non-medical way to the patient.
And that place is pretty forbidding if you're an outsider.
It can be.
Yeah. What led you to the field of anesthesiology?
Well, I actually started out thinking I would be a psychiatrist, which I think plays into my interest in fiction and my interest in the human story. And I got into medical school, and there was one particular patient I was taking care of many, many years ago now who had systemic lupus, and she actually had severe manifestations of it. And she was a poverty-stricken patient. She didn't have the best of care. It was in a charity hospital. And I remember trying to discern which of her body systems were failing and how we could help her, and it drew me into internal medicine because I liked the combination of both the medical and the psychiatric that occurred there. So I was an internist for 3 years, And then I think being the kind of person who needs to focus more on one pathway, I felt a bit scattered in internal medicine. I felt I was trying to take care of too many patients at one time. I also was starting my own family. And therefore, I went into anesthesia, which allowed me to be more specifically focused on one patient at a time, and also to have a little bit more ability to work part-time and be home some with my family. And I really was amazed at how much I've loved this field, how it does combine both the science that I enjoy in medicine as well as the psychiatric, as well as that very intense bond that you make with someone at a frightening point in their life.
Yeah. Now, Marie Heaton, the doctor, is very much a fictional character.
Yes.
You created her. But there are some similarities because she does say at one point in the novel, I love this work. It's precision and focus, which is just what you said. So tell us a little bit about where the two of you diverge.
Yes. The parts of the novel of Oxygen where Marie is talking about anesthesia and the scenes inside the operating room are very much autobiographical. They are very much me. The events that occur in Marie's life are very much non-autobiographical. I'm fortunate. I have never been in a lawsuit, and I've never had any kind of crisis like Marie had to face. On the other hand, Marie is a woman who's gotten fairly far in her career, and while she loves her career and she's invested everything in her career, she also intended to, at one point, make a family, and she's never done that. She's never married. She has a sister, Lori, who has chosen to be a stay-at-home mother and not chosen a career. And I actually have, as you mentioned, four children and a very, very busy and active family. So I'm trying to find that balance that I think a lot of women look for between work and between family. And rather than write about that in a character, since I have not managed to totally conquer that, I've almost divided myself. I think Marie represents the woman I might have been had I not had a family, and Lori, to some degree, represents the woman I might have been had I not gone into medicine.
Yeah. As I mentioned in my introduction, I think one of the themes of the novel is, you know, about what our work provides us, and also maybe sometimes too much of our identity gets caught up in our work.
I think so.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Carol Casella, author of Oxygen. Our guest is a writer. She is also an anesthesiologist. She is the mother of two sets of twins, and she practices medicine in Seattle. She's also a freelance medical writer specializing in global public health advocacy for the developing world. Her novel, Oxygen, is her first. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line four. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting show. Mother of two sets of twins, a doctor and a writer. So what do you do with your free time?
I try to sleep.
Yeah, very admirable. Fantastic. Two quick points, and then I'll ring off for your comments. My wife, several years ago, our youngest daughter had to have some very, very minor reconstructive surgery. Doctor did it with a laser, and she was an infant, and she was knocked out. Just very, very brief time. But I can agree with you, and I can tell you, there's nothing like that feeling being a parent, wondering if you're doing the right thing, worrying about your child. Of course, she came through fine, and she's beautiful and fine today. But it is terrifying. The point I was going to make was I had recently had some very, very minor surgery, and was knocked out and came through with flying colors. But I can tell you the most terrifying thing that happened was when I came to, the doctor said, do you know anybody named Emily? And I think, well, of course, that was my oldest daughter. I said, well, yeah, that's my oldest daughter. And he said, well, during the surgery, you had to be restrained because you kept on yelling, Emily, Emily, get off of me. And I was just, you know, of course, you don't remember anything. I don't even remember going to sleep. But I was wondering, this episodes like that, I mean, I thought the patient was supposed to be, you know, out, knocked out. It was something like having to be restrained, something like that, once the anesthetic is inside. Does that happen that often like that, or do you have any stories similar to that? I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, first one comment. I have been the parent of a child undergoing anesthesia, and I was completely a parent, not at all a doctor in that instance, mm-hmm. and sat out there wringing my hands. What you had for your surgery was almost certainly sedation, deep enough sedation that you have no recall of the event, but it was not a true general anesthetic. And many patients believe that they were asleep when they were actually just sedated enough that they weren't aware of what was going on. And in that case, it is possible for a patient to have a conversation, to move. You're breathing on your own, but you may have no memory at all of being in the operating room. If you were having a true general anesthetic, for instance, for an open abdominal procedure, you would have been much more deeply asleep and unable to move.
That's interesting. So as an anesthesiologist, are there levels that you work within?
Yes. There's conscious sedation, in which a patient is given enough medication to relax them, but they're still aware, they're still able to cooperate, to mm-hmm. hold still, or to answer questions. Then there's deeper sedation, in which a patient is unlikely to be aware, but still is breathing on their own, still their bodily functions are working normally, they may be moving, but they're unlikely to remember anything. And then a general anesthetic, in which really the higher cortex is completely asleep, and patients are not going to remember that unless there's some error that occurred or some problem that occurred. But in general, patients will not remember that. They will not move. And that's what we use for larger operations.
Yeah. Now, in a larger operation, there have been people who've said that claim that they have some recollection of what was said in the operating room. What do you think?
Well, that can occur. Awareness under anesthesia is a very real event. It's very rare. It tends to occur much more often in patients who have some major instability. For instance, they've lost a lot of blood or they have a severe heart condition and their body just won't tolerate all the anesthetic medications we need to give. It's a higher risk during emergency operations where patients may be in a traumatic situation. It's much less likely to occur in a normal patient undergoing a controlled operation. So not something to go in worrying about, but it's definitely a real event and something to talk about with your anesthesiologist if that's something that you're afraid of.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I went under once, totally and completely, and I was so surprised at how quickly it happened. Bam!
It's amazing. Time really evaporates when you're asleep under anesthesia. You can be asleep for 8 hours and wake up and feel that no time has passed. It's quite different than natural sleep in that way.
Mm, very interesting. Let's take another call. A listener in Chicago on line 4. Hello.
Thank you. I was wondering about some alternatives to anesthesia that you may have experienced or heard of. For instance, hypnosis or acupuncture have been employed in this country as well as in other parts. I'm thinking of some Dr. Rosenfeld, who is a retired public educational physician who comments on things, and he said he experienced and observed acupuncture being used on open thoracic surgery, and then some other doctor mentioned hypnosis of a patient that had to be moved in a certain manner to facilitate the repositioning of the body structure. I'm just wondering if you thought of these alternatives as being commendable modalities for alternative to anesthesia.
I think they're very interesting. There are people who are trained in multimodal techniques. We have some people in my own institution who have studied some of the acupuncture techniques. And for some types of surgery, I think those things can be very helpful. I'm not sure they work for everyone, for every procedure. They may be used as an adjunct to add on to more standard anesthetic techniques. And, of course, they require special training, which most standard physicians right now in the United States aren't being trained in and aren't aware of. But I think they're really interesting to explore. Certainly, a patient's mental attitude when they go into anesthesia can make a difference. We've even found that listening to music sometimes can help reduce pain and reduce some complications during anesthesia. There's so much that we don't know about how the mind plays in to your outcome in operations, your outcome in medical illness in general. And I think it's a wonderful pathway that's opening up, and a lot more work is being done in that.
Kitchen Table Wisdom is a book that was written some years ago by a noted lady physician. I don't know if you read that, I look forward to reading your book for similar experiences that we can appreciate.
Nice to know that name. I'll look for that.
Kitchen Table Wisdom. Actually, it's been years now, but she was a guest on the program, the author, a physician, I do believe, somewhere on the West Coast. I want to say Seattle, but anyway, very interesting, her take on medicine, and really a down-to-earth kind of approach, if I'm recalling correctly. It's been quite a while now. Listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, you're invited to do so with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller this afternoon, you and he talked about being a parent of a child that is facing a procedure. And you told him you understood exactly where he was coming from, because when it happened to you, you were not doctor, you were mom. And in this story, Jolene Jansen, the little girl, her mom, Bobby, asks Marie Heaton, "So would you do this?" She wants to know if Jolene was Dr. Heaton's daughter, would she be operated on?
Yes.
What do you think of this question? How often do you hear it?
I do hear it fairly frequently. I think that question, of course, needs to be answered between the surgeon and the patient or their parent, because the anesthesiologist's role is not to judge whether or not surgery is justified. It's how to make that surgery safe. In Oxygen, I really enjoyed writing that scene because I thought it showed the interplay of Marie and her desire to have children, facing Bobby as another mother, as a mother, you know, with Marie wanting to be a mother, and trying to answer a question that Marie can't fully understand because she doesn't have children. And I think until you have children, you cannot possibly fully comprehend the vulnerability that comes with parenthood. I've often felt after I had children that I recognized that nothing else in life could hurt me besides something happening to my children.
Mm. Yet at the same time, Marie Heaton is so devastated by what happens, the death of Jolene. And she is trying to do the right thing as a human being as well in this story.
Right.
So talk about the effect of when something goes terribly wrong like this, the impact it has on the medical personnel who were involved.
Right. Well, that was another issue and question I really wanted to address in this novel, was the distance that I think has grown between patients and physicians. As medicine has gotten more and more technical and more advanced, we can do much more for patients, but there's a much thicker interface frequently. I think patients understand less of what's happening to them, less of what doctors try to explain. Doctors have less time to spend with patients. And in Oxygen, I wanted to show both the family of this child, the mother, and what happens a bit to her, as well as Marie, the doctor, and how devastated she is, not just by the career loss and the financial loss that occurs because of this malpractice suit, but because of the feeling that she can't reach out to this mother and trying to empathize with this mother. The novel is set a few years ago at a time when it was almost taboo for a physician to ever apologize to a patient who had been harmed in medical error. And we're now beginning to realize that actually that's a very beneficial thing. Even if you just look at it legally, it reduces the impact of lawsuits if there's an apology. But I think on a human level, it's critical. I think a physician needs to have the opportunity to reach out to a family and let them know that even if something was obviously an error, obviously the fault of the physician, that they have the chance to apologize and face the family one-on-one and talk about that. And that's finally being encouraged in our society. For a long time, it was not.
You say it reduces the impact of the malpractice claim. Is that because people understand that there are risks, and once the doctor or whoever was at fault says, "Here it is, and I'm so sorry," or how you know, I'm making a terrible apology here, but is there then a connection that allows the family, the survivors, to forgive?
Well, I'm sure that that's an individual event between, you know, in any one situation, it could work out differently. The few studies that have looked at this, and of course it's limited, I don't think they're definitive yet, but they have shown that it may actually reduce the number of lawsuits and the impact of lawsuits. And it raises for me the question of whether some of the lawsuits are a flash of anger at this almost impassive medical world that people feel quite defenseless against. And it can be a bit dehumanizing if you're caught up in a huge medical institution, raced along a pathway that you don't fully understand, and then an error occurs, and you don't really have a human face behind that error, a human face attached to the people involved. And as people have become less friendly, I would say, sometimes with their physicians, I think we've seen more of an impact of the legal world getting involved in struggles between doctors and patients. And I think the ability to apologize, to face one another one-on-one, regardless of how it plays out in the legal world or the economic world, is the first step in trying to make people to help people heal. It obviously can't undo the error, but at least it can make people talk about the fact that this was unintentional and that both sides are hurt. Both the family is hurt, and of course the physician is hurt too. I've seen physicians who stopped their careers after a medical error because they really couldn't deal with the thought of that occurring again.
How do doctors try to grapple with the experience of making an error, of losing a patient, or doing some great harm?
Well, fortunately now there are more mechanisms within hospitals to help. There's more counseling. I think for a long time we tended to sweep it under the rug. It was sort of, well, get back on the horse, get back to work. You knew this was part of it when you became a doctor. Deal with it. And of course, the way we were dealing with it too often was by ignoring it. But it didn't go away. I mean, I do know physicians who have been eaten up inside and really unable to continue their practice because of something that they were never able to fully talk out, never able to really admit how terrible it made them feel. It is, on the other hand, a part of the world. If you are an airline pilot, you have to accept that at some point there may be some complication you can't correct. It's true of many fields, and certainly it's true in medicine. I mean, one of the obvious mantras is do no harm. First, do no harm. And we try to never take a step forward that might cause more harm without knowing that the potential benefit of that way outweighs the risk. But it's always a balance. You're always trying to find the balance between benefit and risk. And to some degree, that's not always predictable.
Yeah. There are so many pressures in medicine, and one of them, and it plays a role in oxygen, is shortages in staff.
Yes.
At our protagonist's hospital, First Lutheran Hospital, they could use some more help in the field that Marie Heaton works in. What do these shortages mean for staff and patients?
Well, in anesthesia, there is currently a shortage. A while ago, when they were first evaluating numbers, it appeared that there would be a surplus of anesthesiologists. And, of course, the training pathway is quite long, particularly when you think of gearing up an entire institution to train a group of residents. The residency takes 4 years. Now, instead, we have an aging population. We have far more surgical procedures that we can do, that we want to offer patients, that patients want to be able to take advantage of. So we actually have an increasing volume of surgeries and not enough anesthesiologists to fully cover them. that's true in many fields of medicine right now. And, of course, the financial picture in medicine is becoming more and more complicated, and the margins are becoming much thinner. So that's putting pressure on college students when they choose fields, what they're going to go into. I think that medicine's doing, at least anesthesia, I think, is doing a very good job of trying to just recognize that we can only do how many operations we can safely do. One wonderful thing about being an anesthesiologist, and one reason I chose this field, is that I do still only work with one patient at a time. Mm-hmm. And in internal medicine, I would have four or five waiting while I was trying to spend as much time as I needed with the person who had brought in extra questions. And that was far more frustrating to me than at least being able to say, here I am in this operating room with this patient, and I will give this person my very best and full attention.
Mm. Let's take another call, a listener in Mackinac, Illinois, which is located in Tazewell County. Line one, hi.
Hello there. There are just so many aspects of this that are fascinating, but I want to go back to the mistakes in the hospital and the previous prohibition of doctors talking to patients about it. It strikes me that this is just fundamental good customer service, that a physician would talk with the patient, acknowledge that there had been a problem, apologize for it, you know, and if it's not a fatal issue, do what they can to remedy the situation. And hospitals are now beginning to change their minds on this, but for years they were throwing up this brick wall that made it impossible for people to feel like they were getting any acknowledgement that something had gone wrong.
Definitely. I think that's true. And I don't know for certain, but I think that some of that may have come about because as lawsuits increased and as insurance premiums increased, perhaps that's the advice that doctors and hospitals were getting. Don't admit an error, because then someone has an excuse to come after you, or it's almost an admission of guilt. And it's taken time for people to realize that's really probably not the case. Plus, I think it was driven by a need. I think too many physicians, I know I would feel this, if I had injured someone, I really can't imagine being able to walk away from that without having a direct conversation with the people involved. I don't really think I could go on living comfortably with myself as a physician or as a human being. And luckily, I think that's beginning to come to the fore. If you look at how rapidly medicine has changed in the last 20 years, there's been so much that we're still just trying to catch up with, really, on a moral basis.
Yes, and I think your point of it being driven by the physician side and their need for action on their own part, I hadn't thought about that, but I think that's a very good thing. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Carol Casella. She is a novelist. She's also a medical doctor. She's an anesthesiologist. Her debut novel has just been published. It is called Oxygen. It is published by Simon & Schuster. We've got about 8-9 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you would like to give us a call this afternoon with questions, comments, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back a little bit to your blog, where one of the entries you talk about one of your children, a boy of 13, so you've got two 13-year-olds.
And two 12-year-olds.
And two 12-year-olds. Whoa.
We were surprised.
Yeah. Well, it's... I imagine at the end of the day, you're pretty pooped. But anyway, talk with us about... Literature has played such an important role in your life. You majored in English literature. What are your kids reading, and how have you, in this day and age, tried to foster a love of reading in their lives?
Oh, good question. I think it's harder these days to foster a love of literature because there's so much competition. Certainly with my son, as I wrote in my blog, he's quite attracted to computers. And I try to recognize that that may be his gift, but still, at this age, I would like him to enforce, in fact, quite a limitation on that and insist on books and insist on play outdoors and a wider variety of things. My children love to read. I live in an area where, in the North Pacific Northwest, where reading is quite popular still, luckily, and they read most of the standard popular children's literature now, Stephanie Myers and Harry Potter, and Suzanne Selfers is another of their favorite authors right now. She's also here on Bainbridge Island. I've had trouble getting them as engaged in the classics, and that's one thing I still struggle with. I keep putting Pride and Prejudice in front of my girls or Lord of the Flies, and they don't always get picked up. But I'm happy to see them reading at any rate.
Yeah, well, 12 and 13—that's pretty young out there. They'll find those books, I think. Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone, line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I was interested in another effect of the former belief or the still lingering belief that an apology is an admission of guilt or can lead to something negative. And I think another effect of that, or possibly I'm wrong, but I would like to know if there is a movement afoot to better track incompetent doctors.
Yes, there is. There is, you may be familiar with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, but there's quite a focus now on reducing medical errors. It's receiving governmental and national attention, as well as far more attention within hospitals. And what we're trying to do now is put in place better specific standardized methods for tracking errors, which would include, of course, tracking physicians who are making repetitive errors. You may know that such a thing is really not a single instituted policy, but rather a process. And in any complicated system, be it aviation, be it transportation or medicine, there are so many places that an error could occur that it really takes a group of dedicated people to try and trace those back to their sources. I think for a long time in medicine, there was a very weak system for helping one physician point out a problem with another physician without feeling that they were ruining a friend's life, ruining a friend's career. Now we are getting better at that. We're instituting mechanisms to make that occur so that a physician who may be making bad judgments can actually be helped as opposed to just penalized, and yet also pulled out of the pathway of positioning, possibly harming patients.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This gets me to ask a question about when there is a personal problem that spills into the professional life, and this comes up in the novel. I don't want to go there. But when a personal problem spills into professional life, what kind of help is there available for someone in that situation?
Well, medicine today has recognized and fully admitted that there are physicians who need specific help, and we've set up pathways to take a physician out of practice and put them through special training, be it anger management or abuse issues or communication issues, and try and rehabilitate that physician, and then monitor them very carefully over the time that they're then placed back into practice to be sure that they are not slipping again into habits that might cause problems. It's obvious to everyone that physicians are human, just like everyone else, but they are in a position of potentially harming patients if their problems should spill into the workplace, and so that does make it somewhat unique. So rather than just pulling patients completely off the line and then doing nothing for them, I think medicine has really made a huge effort to try and rehabilitate physicians who are having personal issues that are impairing them at work.
Yeah. Yesterday we talked with Julie Solomon about her book Hospital, which is about Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. And one of the issues that that hospital had to deal with was rudeness on the part of staff. And it was that was very interesting. And that's, you know, you can see how that could happen in a setting where there's so much stress and strain.
Yes.
But really, they've made an effort to deal with that. And I guess that can be a challenge for healthcare personnel is dealing with their anger and how they're treating their fellow workers.
Yes, exactly. I was going to say not only towards patients now and then,
yeah.
but certainly within the workplace.
Yeah.
And, of course, medicine tends to still be a bit hierarchical. I think some of that's breaking down. When I went to medical school, it was quite distinctly so. And now that there's more crossover and friendship, I think, among the tiers, but it is still very much a hierarchical field. And that not only plays into how we treat one another, but it also can play into safety. For instance, it's very important to allow anyone at any level of the chain to be able to point out a medical error or a potential for a medical error without feeling that they are overstepping or going above someone's head. And my hospital and many hospitals now are trying to pay particular attention to that and allow anyone to, quote, blow the whistle or stop the line and say, we need to stop. I see a potential for error here.
Yeah. It was also interesting to see that in this hospital, one of the changes over time has been, and this hospital goes back, you know, 100 years,
right.
To see that there are patient advocates on staff, too.
That's yes.
Important development.
Yes.
There we have to end it. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so very much, Celeste. It was really quite a pleasure, and I appreciated talking to your listeners.
You're very welcome. Carol Casella has been our guest in this portion of the program. She's a medical doctor. She's an anesthesiologist. She's a mom. She's also a writer, and her debut novel is just out. It's titled Oxygen. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and you'll find our guest online at carolcasella.com. And Casella is spelled with two S's and two L's, C-A-S-S-E-L-L-A. And you can reach her website through ours, will.illinois.edu. Carol Casella's book, Oxygen, the novel, is now out in paperback. We talked with Carol Casella last summer on July 1st of 2008. I'm Celeste Quinn. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Thanks for joining us today. It's 1:53, standing by with settlement prices from Kansas City and Chicago from the Boards of Trade. And as well today with livestock contracts, here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks so much. Let's take a look at those numbers as they finished up in Chicago on this Thursday afternoon. Futures like this. Nearby July wheat finished the day with a 4¾ cent gain, had a high today of $6.46 a quarter, a low at 6.18, a settlement price at $6.30 and a half, up 4¾ for the July. That's the harvest month in Chicago for the soft red winter wheat. September futures, a nickel higher, 6.72, the high, the low at 44¼. Settlement price at 6.56¾, up 5 cents. December contract, 6.94¾, the high, the low at 65½, and a settlement price at $6.78¾ a bushel, up 4½ cents. Back in Kansas City, the harvest month for the hard red winter wheat, 5¾ of a cent higher at $6.80¾ a bushel. In Chicago, corn finished up 2¾ in the nearby. Lead option July, a 4.34¾ top, ranging to a bottom at 4.22½, and a settlement price at $4.28¾. July corn up 2¾. September futures, 4.44¾ the high, the low at 32¾. Settlement price at $4.39, 2¾ higher in December futures. 4.58, the high, the low at 46. Settlement price for the December, this is the harvest month, at $4.52¼. New crop up 2½ cents for December corn. March 2010 contract, 4.68¼, the high, the low at 56¾. And a settlement price at $4.63½, up 3 cents a bushel. Let's go out to December 2010. That'll be the new crop next year, and we'll take a look at that number. $4.50, a settlement price up 2¾ for the day. July oats, 2.50, down 3¾ on the settlement. September, 2.59½, down 2¾ for the day. Soy complex now. July bean futures, $11.97½, the high, the low at 75¼. Settlement price at $11.79, down 8. August, 11.54½, the high, the low at 36¼. Settlement price at $11.40½, down 7 cents. And September futures in the bean pit, 10.99 the high, the low at 82. Settlement price at $10.88, down 2.5 cents. November contract. This is the new crop. There's a split here. The first few months were lower. The next are higher for the day. Up 3 cents in the November. 10.57 1/4 the high, the low at 41.5. Settlement price at $10.53. New November beans up 3 cents. January contract of 2010, 10.59 the high. Low at 10.45, settlement price at 10.55 1/4, up 2 3/4. July bean meal futures, 3.92.10 the high, the low at 3.83, settlement price at 3.83.80, down 2.40, and the August contract at $364.70 a ton, down $3.70. July soybean oil today unchanged, finished at 37.81. August unchanged too, it finished at 37.98. In just about 10 minutes now, I'll return with the closing mark report this afternoon. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's out of Decatur, Illinois. And then later in that program, Peter Levitt will join us to take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. Always comes to you at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time during the closing market report. Here's the way the numbers settled in Chicago's livestock side from the CME Group. Nearby June live cattle futures, an 87.5-cent loss today. 82.40 was the top on the afternoon, the bottom at 81.35, a settlement price at $81.50, down 87.5 cents. August 83 the top for the day, the bottom at 81.75. Settlement price for the August live cattle futures, 81.85, down $1.25. October contract, $89.05, the high, low at $88.20, settlement price at 88.25, down 97.5. And December live cattle futures, $91.25 the high, the low at 90.30, settlement price at 90.47.5, down 67.5 cents. Now the feeder cattle, these are the little ones, 102.60 the high, the low at 101.75, settlement price at 101.82.5, down 62.5 cents for 100 pounds. September 102.70 the high, the low at $101.95, settlement price at 102. Even, down 52.5 cents. In the October feeders, 102.75, the high, the low at $102. Settlement price at 102.25, down 70 cents. In November feeders, 65 lower today, 102.80, the high, the low at 102.40. Settlement price at 102.50, down 65 for the November feeder cattle. June lean hogs, 65.80, the high, the low at 65.30. Settled at 65.40, down, or rather up, 12.5 cents. July at 67.30, top, bottom at 66.85, settled 67, 12.5, 50 cents higher, and the August lean hog futures, 68.35, the high, the low at 68 bucks. Settlement price at 68.12.5, 17.5 higher. October futures, 63.75, the high, the low at 63.30. Settlement price, $63.30, up 2.5 cents for the October lean hogs. Now the frozen pork bellies, nearby contract. Finished the day like this, 73.30 the top, the bottom at 72.50, settled 72.95. July frozen pork bellies up 30 cents, the August down 50 cents to settle at 72.50. I'll be back with the closing market report. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
The Dow is currently up 114 points at 8414, the NASDAQ up 18 at 1749, and the S&P 500 up 13 at 906. Nearby crude oil trading in New York up 163 at 6490. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3. Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. You could call them CSI Wildlife. They're fighting the black market in wildlife, a trade worth as much as $20 billion worldwide. Tomorrow on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at the world's first wildlife forensics lab. Our guest will be journalist Laurel Nimi. She's the author of Animal Investigators, and she'll join us tomorrow following the 1 o'clock news. The forecast is prepared by Mike Sola for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In northern Illinois, partly to mostly cloudy. In northern Indiana and in central Illinois, mostly cloudy with lingering showers and patchy drizzle.